Thank you for joining us at the Roundtable.
Brought to you by Community Education Arts, a nonprofit organization based in Noblesville, Indiana.
I'm Alice Cavanaugh Scober, President of CE Arts.
And I'm Sarah E. Morin, Secretary of CE Arts. Let's sit down at the Roundtable. Diving back into dialect prejudice and racism issues in our books. As we continue discussing all of the other themes in these books, the issues of dialect prejudice and racism will continue to come up. So why don't we start, Alice, with a brief list of what's in each book?
I think that's a really good idea. Yeah, let's do that. Go for it.
Okay. So for Gone with the Wind, dialect is a huge component, and simply the descriptions of Africans, people who are enslaved, and freed blacks. Mm-hmm. Also, there's a lot of references to poor white trash characters, mm-hmm. carpetbaggers, northerners, and Yankees.
And all of those characters have dialect, as do, we must admit, the main characters, the southern gentle class, the richer, wealthy class of southerners, whether they're landowners or not, they have a dialect too, that southern style of speaking. So there's dialect all throughout the book. It's just some of it is more problematic than others. So
that's true. And what I found is because, again, I revisited this through audiobook.
Right.
And so it flows so much more naturally when you hear it read out loud mm-hmm. versus that huge stumbling block you'd have when trying to read very yeah. heavy dialect where they spell the words differently. And so to me, it sounded smooth both ways. Mm-hmm. Now, as you read it on the page, would you compare, like, when the main characters, mm-hmm. like Scarlet, like mm-hmm. Rhett,
or Ashley, or Rhett, or somebody, yeah.
Yes, any of those genteel Southerners. Would you say that it is as heavy of misspellings? Because
for lack of a better phrase, only when it's the white trash, white people, and like carpetbaggers, northerners, there's a lot more of that dialect style of writing, which in the previous episode, when I was talking about linguistics and language and dialect, that the fact is that in any region or area, there's going to be a dominant style of dialect. Okay, and in Gone with the Wind, it's safe to say that the Scarlet, the Ashley, the Rhett, the, you know, those people have the dominant dialect. And so it is written by Margaret Mitchell as what you might call regular English or normative English is what applied linguistics would call it, more like a normative English. It's the prestige dialect, if you will, which sounds terrible. That's a bad phrase, but that's a phrase out of anthropology. But even Gerald O'Hara, who is Scarlett's father, he's an Irishman. He's, you know, an immigrant who was not wealthy by birth. His dialect in the book has that Irish lilting and spelling and not as bad as a James Joyce, you know, not like James Joyce writing, which is really hard to read and decipher. You can understand what Gerald O'Hara is saying, but Margaret Mitchell did try to write in some of that Irish dialect, Irish-American dialect, if you will. So I think that the dividing lines are within the white communities and then between the white and the black communities in the book, definitely. And it's a spectrum of dialects that runs through the entire book.
Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, that's just... Yeah. You know, and I think you allude to having heard that as you listen to it in audio. I'm sure you know that flows more conversationally. It sounds more like real life, if you will. If you were living in an area and a time period where okay. those dialects were present, I'm not at all trying to say that that's how we hear and speak today here in Noblesville, Indiana, or anywhere. You know, I mean, I've been in the South recently, and there's a lot of dialects in the South from all kinds
yes.
of people. So, dialects exist, you know, whether or not we like them or they make us uncomfortable in classic literature is a whole other conversation, which is sort of what we're having today a little bit.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Okay,
so what do you think about Dracula in dialect?
Right, so with Dracula, there's a colonial viewpoint.
Yeah.
Definitely, all things Britain are held up as the banner.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially wealthy, noble class of gentlemen
versus
people of lower classes and less wealth.
Yeah.
And kind of that dichotomy of, you know, the city and the country.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's very true. And also foreignness. Dracula is not British. You know, there's a section very early on in the book when he's talking to Jonathan where he is very pro-British. He's very excited about going to England and he loves everything British and he has all these books. But we know that he loves England and wants to go to England because he wants to suck the blood of all the Englishmen, you know. He wants to devour England, you know. It's not because he thinks colonialism or being a Britophile is, you know, the thing to do. But yeah, I think Dracula is our most colonial sounding book, if you will. And the fact that there's so much in the beginning in, quote, Jonathan Harker's journal passages, end quote, that really Bram Stoker went into a lot of detail about the indigenous people of the area that Dracula lives in and where the castle is and everything. It's probably going to be startling to some people how colonialism comes through in those descriptions and everything. So,
sure. You also have mentioned here in your notes here about Quincy Morris, the American, specifically the Texan.
Yeah.
He's a character that I loved, even though he's such a broad type.
I know. I'm not sure how much research went into him, but from Bram Stoker's point of view. But what I do want to mention about both Quincy and Van Helsing, who are, from the viewpoint of the proper British gentlemen and women in the book characters, they're foreigners, okay? Van Helsing being German and Quincy Morris being from America, Texas, America, they still are foreign, you know, and yet our little group of heroes and the British good guys and everything, they accept them. They don't see Quincy and Van Helsing quite as the outsiders that, say, the people who live in Dracula's area are looked at, okay?
Right.
And the difference being in Van Helsing's, I think, in Van Helsing's character is his intelligence, his age, his wisdom. He's like the professor. He is the professor. I shouldn't say he's like the professor. The doctor. They look up to him for all those reasons. And Quincy represents this, you know, kind of true blue manliness that they look up to. So they respect those two foreigners a lot more than, say, some of the other, you know, much lesser characters in the book.
Absolutely. I still think, though, the idea of equating that which is foreign with that which is, you know, esoteric and mysterious, and that definitely is there with Van Helsing, because he's the one with that mysterious knowledge, and he's only dripping
out
in dripping
drafts. It's just not a lesserness, whereas with so many, with, you know, the way that we hear in the book that they're easy to find if you're looking for them. If you're not looking for them, it's a little more subtle than you might think, but the kind of white superiority, you know, and everybody else is lesser, or even British superiority, and everybody else, all the other foreigners are lesser. Van Helsing's not seen as lesser because he's German, and that's the distinction that I would say puts him in the more esteemed category. I guess there's a hierarchy of foreignness, and he rates
right.
The top, you know. So,
no.
Yeah.
No, I think you are right. I think that there is a hierarchy. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Okay, so move on to Little Women, which I guess for some people this would probably have the least, you know, the least amount of dialect and issues. But what do you think about that one?
Definitely there's reference to German immigrants, immigrants in general. Mm-hmm. I remember some references to the Irish children who were their antagonists that keeps popping in there.
I know, and it's like, why were they the antagonists? Just because they were
right.
Irish, you know, and the fact that Louisa May Alcott chose to put the label Irish in there, and I'm doing air quotes in our Zoom video that I just realized our podcast can't see, but, you know, she could have just said other children or some children. She didn't have to call them Irish, but she did. And there is a little bit of dialect throughout the book, mostly from the part of German immigrants or some other group that isn't, well, I don't know what you would call it. The main characters, our main little group. Even Professor Bear has some dialect in his speech.
Oh, yeah.
And he's German. So, again, he's not looked down on. He's not seen as lesser in Little Women, really.
Right.
Except
it
I think
is a hierarchy.
I think when he first comes on the scene, I think Laurie does make some kind of disparaging remarks about "you're German," you know, "you're," like to Joe, he says, "oh yes, you're German man," or "you're German fellow," or something like that. So he kind of makes it sound a little meh, you know, but that's
right.
Mostly
and
just...
It's hard to tell if he means it in a racist kind of way, or if he means it because, hey, this is who, the person I used to be interested in, this is who I see her eye on.
Exactly.
So it's a little hard.
But think of this, Louisa May Alcott chose to have Laurie say German fellow or German like gentleman or whatever instead of just your fellow, your new guy, this man you've met, your friend. Oh, I think it's German friend. I think that's what he says. And it's like, why doesn't she just have Laurie say, oh, you're thinking about your friend? She put the word German in there for him to say. And so it's those kinds of very subtle and interesting things that make us realize that at that time period, again, it's all about cultural context. When Louisa May Alcott wrote the book and the time period in which she set that story, having that German immigrant status was not elevated, just like with the Irish. She put Irish with the children, Irish children. That was a lower status, and it's very subtle. And that's the kind of thing that I find in language in classic literature really interesting. So I'm a geek. What can I say? I'm a language geek.
We can delve more into that, I think, when we talk about Professor Bear. Because
yes.
I would say that I read it as Joe likes him because of his odd German ways. I think she finds that attractive.
Oh, I think she's very interested in the otherness of him.
Yes.
And I think that speaks to Louisa May Alcott to a certain degree. I think I think in her own personal life she always was drawn to the non-normative female role of, you know, her life, and she had a different kind of outlook, and Joe represents that a lot of the time, and I feel like that's one of those scenarios that is very representative of the true author, the real life person, imbuing a character with a little bit of herself. And
sure.
I think it worked really well. With Jane Eyre, there's actually a lot more in Jane Eyre than I remembered or thought until I did my reread. So, and again, I probably found things a little more, you know, detailed than a quick read might have done, but I was looking for them, so.
Sure, so those things include references to Turks,
yep,
Germans, Creoles, Gypsies, you know, the most infamous scene being Rochester disguising himself as a gypsy fortune teller.
Yeah, that's a weird scene in general. Just across the board, that's a weird scene, but the way the gypsies are characterized within that scene is pretty bad. It's it's pretty discriminatory. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. References to Indian references,
yeah.
References to Jewish people,
yeah.
And any others you can think of?
Those were the top ones that struck me. And again, in my reading of them, what occurred to me, and again, understanding that Charlotte Bronte is writing from a certain time period that she lived in, and her characters are set in a certain time period, what struck me is that in every instance where an actual, say for example, nationality, like German or a religion like being Jewish or anything is actually stated, if the word Jew or German or Creole is stated, if you read that passage or that sentence or that phrase and take that word out, you could still have the same thought coming from a character. The same statement could have been made without the insertion of that word, Jew, German, Creole, whatever. And so that is something that I feel like, again, comes from the author more than is a character thing. It's being used by the author probably without even realizing it. And, you know, there's a lot of conversations about white privilege going on right now, and it's almost like an example of white privilege, where to say Jew usurer, I can't say that word, when usury on its own, with usurer is the word you need. You don't need Jew in front of usurer, because it's not being Jewish that you want to, it's the usury, you know, the money lending or whatever, usury, I can't even remember, I think usury is money lending, but, or greediness or something about money, and to put the, put Jew in front of that as a pejorative is completely unnecessary, because the definition of the usurer is pejorative, you know? So that's where you start to see that even in Charlotte Bronte's lifetime and in her writing, that element of white privilege comes through, because she's able to use those kind of those words like in a pejorative manner, Jew, German, Creole, Turks, you know, that kind of thing. So that's what struck me on the rereading of this book, going into our discussion this year.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, Alice, and I think that helps in my mind, thinking about how any reference that Margaret Mitchell has to race in Gone with the Wind does develop the setting or the characters and their viewpoint.
Yes.
Whereas most of the references in Jane Eyre that single out a nationality, most of them are incidental. So that is, I think, definitely been coming from the author's own viewpoint. The only exception being the gypsies, definitely, that you can't remove the gypsy reference and still have that scene.
Right, but no, and I didn't list that in my Germans, Jews, Turks, because I and Creoles, because I do believe that that the gypsies, and we shouldn't even call them gypsies, we just call them Rom, you know, the Rom people, through time, across the world, have been abused, and the word gypsy is a pejorative. It's a negative, and I think that it's used in Jane Eyre is again culturally appropriate for the time period it was written in, and culturally appropriate does not mean pleasant, does not mean comfortable. It just means we can understand why Charlotte Bronte wrote that scene using the word gypsies. It would not have occurred to her to use the word Rom at all. I mean, that just would not have been in her vocabulary. Right. So that's not to say that all white privilege perspectives, all of our authors are white, okay? So all of them have, my doorbell's ringing, I'm not answering it. all of our books have that element of white privilege in them. We can accept that and also look at the time period and the cultural context and all that stuff that we've already talked about. And we're going to probably have to keep mentioning that as we have the discussions about all the problematic issues that we both find in these books, that it's not just limited to racism or prejudice. We've got in our list of topics, we've got class, we've got domestic violence, we've got all kinds of, you know, issues that are sort of negative. And then we get to talk about romance, you know, so we have other things to talk about in relation to our books, but I think we're going to come back over and over with that, with kind of like an almost apologetic, this is an example of white privilege writing, or this is an example of dialect that makes us very uncomfortable, but in the cultural context of when it was written or when the story takes place, it's culturally appropriate, you know, doesn't make it pleasant or anything like that. So we're kind of, you know, trying to deal with all these issues to go along with our project goals, you know.
Right.
Which I would ask you now, if you would sum up our project goals again, just so we know what they are.
sure, absolutely. So the goal of NICE is to breathe new life into classics by encouraging critical thinking, discussion of the works that we select, and to experiment with creativity.
Yes, always.
And Great. So with keeping those in mind, we're going to do our best to discuss anything unpleasant, anything that's uncomfortable about the book choices. But we, while we're doing that, we're going to understand the cultural context of the times in which they were written, and also the periods in which the stories are set, such as Gone with the Wind, which was written later than the setting of the book. And also, just how do these books relate to the world today? We're going to take a deep dive into that as well.
Yeah, that's going to be fun.
This has been At the Roundtable with Alice
and Sarah E.
of Community Education Arts.
Our nonprofit organization is based in Noblesville, Indiana. You can find us online at cearts.org.
This activity made possible in part with support from the Indiana Arts Commission and the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
We'd like to thank James Weston for writing our intro music and for his technical savvy.
Join us next time
at the Roundtable.